Chapter 32. Tilly. Price Point, the highly combustible action orgy, directed by Raymond Lang, written by Cecil Abrams, and starring the who's who of my acting generation, was for me an experience not unlike my first real sexual encounter. That is to say, a painful inevitability that seemed like a good idea in the moment, but failed miserably to live up to my expectations. Calvin, Cal, Kleinsbar, my randomly selected 10th grade natural sciences lab partner, had been more than just a little attractive. The wrestling, or was it football, gave him physical presence. He was easy to pick out of a crowd. He had muscle and nice skin and large white teeth. There was something vaguely collegiate about him. The girls liked to call Cal California Kleinsbar, or Calvin Klein, or just Clydesdale, to evoke a rather graphic comparison, purely imagined, with the equine anatomy. In the hallways of Wilson High, Cal was a model of confidence, the kind exuded into the atmosphere like a fragrance by those whose personal assets are readily apparent and self-executing. He was cool. He was suave. He wore sunglasses inside. Someone called him Calvin Coolidge. Helping matters greatly, and perhaps this goes without mention, Cal had all the right friends securely in his orbit. People courted his attention, and many of those people whose attention I courted earnestly recommended my affections. We were made for each other, I was told. Possible homecoming material. At the very least, I was assured that passing up an opportunity to date California Kleinsbar, or to decline a ride on the Clydesdale, as one of my friends had so delicately put it, would have been a waste of immeasurable good fortune. So I did not resist, as I should have, a friend of a friend's invitation to the party at Rounder Lake. He would be there. He knew I would be there. Stars were aligning. The party at Rounder Lake. There was my first lesson in false advertising. For it turned out that Calvin's trailer was but an egregious misrepresentation of the feature film. For all his schoolyard suave, in the back of his brother's station wagon, Cal had the sensitivity and finesse of a starving junkyard Rottweiler presented with a warm slab of meat. He kept his sunglasses on. I suppose that much of him was true. To belabor that memory serves little point, except this. After so many decades of reflection, it occurs to me that my experience in filming Price Point was not altogether different than my 26-minute relationship with California Kleinsbar. Indeed, I am reminded powerfully of Orrin Twill's likening of Hollywood to a beast laying low in tall grasses, and knowing far more about its prey than its prey knows about itself. Price Point, I was told, was a match made in heaven. Milton Chenoweth was convinced it was exactly the mainstream launch I needed to show that I had not been born again as an art house literary movie darling, or at least not a committed one, saved From the anti-intellectual, apolitical, comically orgiastic leanings that had marked my early Eineman films. Price Point was to ground my professional reputation and pull me out of the dispiriting misstep that was The Lion Tree. And best of all, success was guaranteed. A sure thing. For reassurance, I needed to look no further than the roster of all the right people, the A-list involved in the project. Darnell Lewis behind the camera, Raymond Lang, Cecil Abrams, and a production team with a golden resume, sharing a co-lead role with Zach West, the golden boy himself. Good fortune did not stare more directly into one's eyes. Simon Hunter, Milton's well-tailored London-born acolyte at Chenoweth, Taylor, and Reed, the agent to whom the legwork in the advancement of my career had been so deftly delegated, liked to refer to Price Point as the project. "It's the hottest project on the map, Tills," Simon liked to say. "Damn good news, Tills. Fulton McKenzie has just signed on." His breathless dispatches from the back rooms and the top floors of the Hollywood machine were of Californian syntax wrapped in a high-rent British accent. "Everyone is like totally buzzing about the project, Tills. Cecil tells me people are ringing him up from all over the world." An hour with Simon over lattes, and one could easily begin to think Price Point was the name of some colossal humanitarian undertaking in the jungles of the Third World, or some record-breaking marvel of civil engineering, an improbable bridge or skyscraping tower of glass. But Price Point was, in the end, just a movie, and not an especially good or successful one. It delivered action without suspense, conflict without drama, characters lacking of all things character. Certainly nothing of the beautiful and brilliant Sienna Price required much digestion. I recall how quickly I came to loathe the cartoon that was my alter ego. She offered no surprises. Or rather, her surprises were all shallowly and predictably manufactured. A leggy neurosurgeon, only 35 years old. She was skilled at Taekwondo and a crackerjack amateur pilot, an aptitude put to exceedingly good use when it came to taking control of a jet aircraft on a fiery collision course for the White House. Sienna was inexplicably but respectably proficient with knives and semi-automatic weapons. She knew a little Farsi. For all her beauty, she was gritty and determined in a fashion model neurosurgeon sort of way. Of course, Price Point was not nearly so much about the lovely and competent Sienna as it was about her husband, Jack Price, the disaffected spy whom the trailers showed saving the free world in a ball of fire. Milton had grossly oversold me on Sienna as a co-leading role. For all the tricks up her sleeve, she was but a sexy uxorial window dressing for at least half the film. The plot has her abducted at a medical conference in Bahrain, wearing the blouse, skirt, and heels she wears throughout the unrelenting action of the rest of the film. accessorized only by the ropes and electrical tape of her abduction. It was clear from the script that the bondage fetishists were to be, if not the target demographic, then at least the most satisfied demographic. The ballyhooed writers and director were keen on having it both ways with Sienna. From the time of her abduction until roughly mid-film, with only the fabric of her skirt and an idealistic young terrorist to protect her from the more plentiful, loathsome, and strangely lustful variety, Sienna was the helpless, blindfolded damsel in distress, slung from jeep to cellar to desert munitions tent like a sexy sack of potatoes. Husband Jack, meanwhile, moved heaven and earth to defeat evil and rescue his wife. That Jack Price actually does neither of these things, and that his wife ultimately takes matters into her own hands, were contrivances that only served to simultaneously cheapen the cause of feminism and annihilate Price Point's credibility as a non-animated film. Once Sienna and her perfectly unshaven, unconscious spouse are loaded into a luxury jet destined for Washington, she undergoes a transformation far less credible than those transformations in the tradition of Peter Parker, David Banner, and Clark Kent. Without warning, she becomes a stony killing machine, gutting libidinous gun-wielding Arabs, breaking the necks of a pilot and co-pilot with graceful single-twist screw-top precision, pulling the screaming jet out of a dive into the White House rotunda, and parachuting to safety, limp husband in her arms, as the United States Air Force blows the plane out of the sky, sending it down into the sleepy Potomac. I was not, at that time in my life, in much of a position to stick my nose in the air over shallow or ridiculous characters. I had played my share, probably more of those than any other. In fact, before landing the role of Katie Finn in Peppermint Grove, I had played characters that made Dr. Sienna Price look horribly complicated by comparison. So I resolved, mostly in hindsight, that my antipathy for Sienna Price was evidence of my own personal growth and maturation as an actor. More than once in the making of that film, as I posed and grimaced and heaved Sienna through the sand and the sweat and the plot points of her predicament, I found myself asking a question I never would have asked, even 6 months earlier. Whatever will Angus think of all this? The Price Point Project was remarkable for more than its overindulgence in banality. On the fifth take of the parachute scene, strapped to the Golden Boy's limp, flawless body, and harnessed to safety wires that were supposed to suspend us from a crane, I leapt from a gimbal set made to look like a Gulfstream jet and fractured two of my ribs. The harness, defective, I later learned, had simply had enough strain and it gave way with an awful tearing sound, sending Zach and me 8 feet to the floor, screaming. From the Price Point executives, there came a flurry of concern and hand-wringing that quickly metamorphosed into a tidy sum of dollars. Since Darnell Lewis was shooting scenes out of order, the accident had occurred relatively early in the production. Determined to stay on schedule, he shot around the inconvenience working on the bulk of the Jack Price storyline while I recuperated. Milton Chenoweth sent me flowers. Blair Gaines sent flowers twice and called incessantly for a week. My mother threatened to fly out to Los Angeles and even went as far as to compare airfares and weigh options for the care of my younger brother, since, in her opinion, my father could not be counted on. My doctor marveled over my exceptional recuperative powers. But I owed far more on that score to my mother and her professional codependency than I did to my good health or a compassionate God. Simon Hunter launched himself rather overzealously into the role of outraged protector, which I found sweet but unconvincing. Simon would sooner have gnawed off his own arm than bite the hand of Cecil Abrams. His indignant tantrums were in the privacy of my company and for my exclusive benefit. But there was no question that Simon desperately wanted to be the kind of person who would draw blood in a rage over my best interests, and this sincerity I found was almost as touching as it was pathetic. Strangely, it was the golden boy, Zach West, formerly Zell Whippo, who, apart from my mother, seemed the most genuinely appalled at the failed double body harness. I suspect this was because it had been the weight of his own body that had snapped the bones protecting my heart, and he felt a misplaced sense of responsibility. It was Zach who rode with me to the hospital in the back of the ambulance, and Zach who raised hell with one associate producer after another, and Zach who took it upon himself to keep me apprised of the progress of the film in my absence. He called me almost daily from Nevada, where they had decided to build the terrorist training camps, and sent me text messages during those times when there is nothing for an actor to do on a movie set except watch the crew reposition with lights and equipment. When I returned to the set some weeks after the accident, Zach was attentive in ways that he had not been previously. Even strapped to my nearly naked, blood-streaked body in a defective harness. The tabloid press, which, in the interests of cheap publicity, had been given periodic free access to the set, took a keen interest in Zach's uncharacteristic solicitude. Stories and photos began to surface. The Bachelor and the Siren was the first thematic angle, which evolved into a Hollywood future power couple in the making theme, followed by, ironically, a tale of cynical sex to manipulate publicity and boost box office receipts. From what I could tell, no one on the set seemed to take the media spin with much surprise, which meant either that they believed the stories entirely, or that they disbelieved them entirely, or, just so the irony might feed upon itself, that they did not much care one way or the other about the veracity of the gossip, as long as the publicity prolonged the media buzz and boosted box office receipts. Similar disinterestedness could not be said of Simon Hunter, whose mood began to cycle between various shades of brooding and an almost manic representational zeal, causing him to recommend every half-baked movie project on the horizon just as an excuse to take a meeting over lunch. He ran interference with the press whenever he could, and privately found creative ways to disparage Zach West as a wolf. "Yes, well, I'll tell you something, dear Tills. According to my sources at Paramount, Zachy old chap may just have a little paternity problem brewing. Poor girl. An intern to the production assistant on the Juggernaut picture last year. Never know if these things are true, but still, a girl should be careful with that one." If Price Point had become my project in that year of my life, then I had become Simon Hunter's project. Although he rarely overtly untethered himself from the professional purpose that justified his time, Simon quickly took on the devotional qualities of a Labrador retriever, threatening to blur the line that separates professional agent from sycophantic groupie. Simon's was a tenacious infatuation, and so sincere I had not the heart to disabuse him. Perhaps instinctively, I charted a fool's course between the Scylla of rejection and the Charybdis of false encouragement. In the end, Simon was truest to his gender, hearing only what he wanted to hear and understanding only what he wanted to understand. However cold and heartless it might have felt, I would have been well advised to set him straight in the beginning. I know now, after all this time, that I should have set them both straight. For I was no more honest with Zach West than I was with Simon Hunter. The difference, as if it matters, is that the engine of my unconscious deceit of Zach West was not compassion, but vanity. The unforgivable truth is that while I felt no greater emotion for the golden boy than I did for Simon, his affection for me brought out a strange and ugly satisfaction. To be sought by Zach West, while provoking no return ardor on my part, gave some credence to my own misguided sense of arrival. Everyone seemed to understand that the golden boy was mine, if only I would have him, and this alone, far more than my acting or even my role in a project like Price Point, considerably improved my stature in the entertainment world. To revel in reflection is common narcissism. To revel in the reflection of rumor is celebrity. Whatever my remarkable recuperative powers when it came to broken ribs, I had no immunity to Hollywood's peculiar plague. Zell Whippo was born a Long Island Jew to a mother who worked as a professional fundraiser and to a father who owned both a successful accounting practice and a less successful sandwich franchise. The sandwich franchise, renowned for its Philly cheesesteak, was unfairly maligned by the New York Board of Health for a single case of botulism that, in all truth, may or may not have been due to a faulty refrigeration unit in an establishment Mordecai Whippo had purchased from a predecessor. Zell's mother's notorious affair with a museum director precipitated a divorce that ultimately spun young Zell, then only 10, out of the Long Island Silver Spoon orbit westward to the beaches of Santa Monica, where he lived with his maternal aunt. Aunt Lucy made her fortune as a real estate broker. Aunt Lucy's live-in eye candy, Vance Cassidy, was a surfing instructor and freelance model of some local repute. A short decade later, under Vance's close tutelage, Zell Whippo became Zach West, the golden boy, striding out of the Pacific Ocean, blonde and built and dripping with a laid-back hippie charm wholly alien to his Long Island progenitors. My courtship with Zach, for misguided or not, it was a courtship, certainly had its moments in which I believed that I had found, at last, a normal romance. But that is surely the wrong way to put it, for there are no normal romances in Hollywood, and there was nothing, in fact, normal about any relationship between the golden boy and anyone else, including me. Judged against the Midwestern values of my father, there was nothing normal about ceding authority over my love life to the dictatorship of public opinion, which itself is governed by a fetish for the abnormal, if not the outright perverse. It is the fireworks of romantic immolation that they all come to see, and ultimately, Zach and I were but another pair of Hollywood Roman candles. There were moments in which my relationship with Zach felt, if not normal, then, for lack of a better word, appropriate. Significantly, we were contemporaries by birth, sharing the emotional resonance of a common generation, and he respected me as his equal. If anything, I was Zach's intellectual superior. But we did not have a relationship that did much to test those kinds of difference. Had it occurred in any environment other than Hollywood, documented in letters and private photos rather than the tabloid press, it was a relationship of which I think my parents would have approved. For all his attention, and for a man of his general exuberance, Zach's declarations of affection for me were infrequent and understated. I tended to dismiss them as aberrational feelings brought on by those drugs beyond his trusted stash of grade A cannabis. Zach was known to experiment, and I never quite knew who he would become when he did. In any event, I assumed, wrongly, I now believe, that he always saw me as a convenient co-star dalliance, or a figment of the imaginary world in which he lived. Actors are so often unable to separate the life acted from the life lived. I believed that in his mind, we were Jack and Sienna Price, and that eventually he would simply replace the Price Point movie poster in his head with something else. Until then, I was content to play the part for my own purposes. I did not love him beyond the love I had for the public relationship itself. It did not occur to me that Zell Whippo still had a voice, that he had been tossed unceremoniously into the surf, and that he could not swim in those waters. I have few memories left of Zach West that do not prominently feature the sounds and smells and surreal blues and greens of the ocean. He taught me the basics of surfing, for one thing. I was horrible at it then, as I was horrible at it for the following 30 years on the increasingly rare occasions that I found my way back to the ocean before retiring from that sport altogether. But I have thoroughly enjoyed my ineptitude, and I thought of Zach fondly when I retched the brine from my lungs and people raced for the breakers to save an old crazy woman from drowning. Zach was known for his Bacchanal beach parties. Grand affairs he hosted once a month at his home. Unlike my own foray into the business, Zach's professional ascension deserved the meteoric cliché. Although he had always enjoyed the comfort of an inherited affluence, he had become extraordinarily wealthy almost overnight, with three record-shattering back-to-back blockbuster action extravaganzas. The beachfront estate, which was on the far western end of Playa de los Leones, in West Malibu, roughly beneath Encinal Canyon, had been a recent acquisition, and Zach put it to immediate use as a centerpiece to his off-screen reputation. His parties were always lavishly catered events, where the food and alcohol were as plentiful as the ocean view. Popular local bands, always acoustic, took turns setting up on a sprawling lawn near the house. Zach, who had taught himself to play the bongos, frequently appeared out of nowhere, wet hair and sandy feet, wearing a pair of ratty surfing trunks, his perfect body slick with the late afternoon sun, and, setting down his bottle, would proceed to accompany whatever song was in progress, regardless of whether it needed or could musically tolerate any percussive assistance. But it was, after all, Zach's party, and the guests, if not the musicians, seemed to love the apparent spontaneity of those increasingly predictable moments. The beach parties may as well have been a movie set like any other. The place where Zach was called upon to breathe life into the recurring character of his own public image. It was as though a Zach West action figure, and there was, in fact, such a thing, showed up to throw a beach party for the 200 people who, as of that particular month, comprised the Hollywood A-list. The beach party action figure, however, did not resemble the grimly determined, adrenaline-charged character that Zach so frequently portrayed in the movies. Quite the opposite. The golden boy of Playa de los Leones sported a personal style of shallow, laid-back affability, caring only enough about anything or anyone to ensure that he could extract from the marrow of every experience a good time for himself and his friends. Famously apolitical and spiritually open to the point of emptiness, Zach welcomed all comers and preached an ethic of unconcern, snuffing out seriousness and overly earnest intellectual discussion wherever it was found. All of life, he seemed to suggest, was really just a party at the beach, not to be spoiled by too much thinking. In apparent contradiction to this ethic of unconcern, Zach deliberately crafted his guest lists to include industry rivals and political demagogues so that the latest catfighting divas and the polemics of the Iraq War had at least some token representation around the bonfire. The gossip rags started calling these events the Zach West Peace Parties, and featured photos of notoriously warring celebrities, stars and politicians and entertainment moguls, arm in arm in the waves, or tangled in a hammock, or toasting the sunset with full bottles of wine. People who had previously sparred, often viciously, over everything from stem cell research to Iraq, to trifling ex-boyfriends. Those who would not lay down arms could either work it out in a game of volleyball or be tossed together into the surf, no matter the attire. As time passed, the surf tossing grew increasingly rare, perhaps because it generally proved counterproductive in shepherding people toward the light of unconcern. Some of these tragic, marked souls were indeed very concerned. Since salt water is unkind to fine clothing, and since the well-dressed drowned rat image is bad by any measure. A few inglorious photos of angry wet celebrities and Zach's beach parties became an anticipated and rigorously covered media event. The guest lists were routinely leaked, just to sharpen everyone's attention and to solidify Zach West as one of the more active, even if not the most important, arbiters of A-list status. The press, never invited to these affairs, was impossible to exclude because the large, irregularly shaped swath of sand in front of Zach's home, while very difficult to reach, was technically public. As the sun began to extinguish itself into the Pacific, a row of round, glowing orange stains would appear along an eastern escarpment, like a line of burning cigarettes, where the telephoto lenses quietly closed the distance between the party raging below and the morning headlines. But for all the anger and post-party fallout that these antics generated, they worked just enough of the time to enhance Zach's reputation. Generous to a fault, he was known as a peacemaker of curious but effective methods. His highly public affinity for marijuana and his belief that a good high was inimical to all conflict earned Zach the dubious title of Mahatma Gandhi. The Zach of Playa de los Leones was a man of simple but genuine priorities that left no room for stress, judgment, pessimism, or conflict of any kind. He quickly became known as the good-natured surfer whose rugged, hard-boiled movie persona was wholly at odds with the real man. But the truth was that the real man was nothing like either Mahatma Gandhi surfing the cosmos of unconcern, nor the hard-body, gun-porn golden boy that grimaced through a series of flame-painted movie posters. The real man was scrawny Zell Whippo from Long Island. It may have been Zach West who cracked my ribs in a defective body harness, but it was Zell Whippo who felt guilty about it. It was Zell Whippo who called me every day, and Zell Whippo who expressed genuine anger at how such an accident could have been allowed to happen. After many years of reflection, I have come to believe that it was Zell Whippo, and not either of his famous alter egos, that had feelings for me. The golden boy lacked sentiment, and certainly Mahatma Gandhi would not have been capable of expressing such tortured feelings of affection. Only Zell was capable of the feelings that would ultimately unravel us.